podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
At present, more than 25 million Americans need therapies to manage their chronic pain. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that the total economic burden from abuse of one such therapy, prescription opioids, including the cost of healthcare, lost productivity, addiction treatment, and criminal justice, is nearly $80 billion U.S. dollars per year. I am Barbara Lopez-Kunz, Global Chief Executive of DIA. Today, our guest is Dr. Nora Volkow, Director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, or NIDA, at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. Dr. Volkow will deliver the keynote address at the upcoming DIA 2018 Global Annual Meeting in Boston this June. She joins us today to discuss this critically important topic and preview her keynote address for us. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Volkow, and welcome.
Thanks very much, and thanks for having me.
We're delighted that you're joining us, and I'd like to start the conversation by first talking a bit about NIDA. Could you tell us, when was NIDA established, and what was the initial purpose?
NIDA is the National Institute on Drug Abuse. It's one of the institutes at the NIH, and it was established as a separate entity in 1974. Before that, it was part of three different institutes that actually whose mission was to look at diseases that affect the brain and that ultimately will result one of them in NIDA, the other one, National Institutes of Mental Health, and the final one is the Alcohol Institute. And the decision to separate these institutes was to protect resources and to be able to focus on the enormous complexity associated with the effects of drugs and ultimately addiction. And so they created the National Institutes on Drug Abuse in order to basically accelerate and advance the science on the causes and consequences of drug use and its implication to the health of the individual.
This is a very, very broad topic, and I imagine that there are many organizations that NIDA collaborates with. Is that true?
Absolutely. And in fact, in order for us to be successful in our mission, which is to bring the power of knowledge into solutions for prevention and treatment of substance use disorders, for us to succeed, we have to partner with multiple institutions. To start with, for example, we have very strong partnership with other institutes at the NIH. And for example, as we're discussing the problem that we're facing with the opioid crisis, a very close partner for us is the National Institutes of Neurological Diseases, which is the other institute at the NIH that focuses a significant amount of resources in order to understand pain and to help develop medications. Outside of the NIH as an organization, we partner very, very close with other sister agencies at the HHS, for example, very closely with SAMHSA, because SAMHSA is the agency that provides the treatment for substance use disorder, most of the treatment of substance use disorder in our country. So being able to bring the knowledge into practice requires that collaboration. We also have close collaborations with the Food and Drug Administration because one of our priority areas at NIDA has been to accelerate the development of medications for the treatment of substance use disorders, including opioid addiction. And that requires that we work closely with FDA in order to be successful. We have also partnership with agencies that are completely outside HHS, like the Department of Justice. And this is because, unfortunately, many individuals suffering from an addiction may end up at one point in their lives in the criminal justice setup. And that is an important opportunity to try to provide treatment for them while they are in the justice system and to link them with healthcare once they leave that system. We work also with the Department of Education because we have learned by now that the most important intervention we can do is prevention. And prevention should be started as you're dealing with any behavior that is risky, as it's the case for drug taking, during childhood and sustained during adolescence and in the transition into young adulthood. And there the partnership becomes very, very relevant. We also have partnerships with industry, incredibly important for us to succeed because we provide the science, but our mission is not to actually bring medications into the clinic. That's what pharmaceutical industry does. So throughout the years, we have been very successful in creating public-private partnerships that actually have led to basically the medications that currently are available for the treatment of many of the addictions, certainly the ones that are related to opioid addiction, as well as medications that are now being used to reverse overdoses. So those partnerships are fundamental in our success as an agency.
Very interesting. It really speaks to the breadth of the issue that we're talking about. And I'm pleased to hear that touch points that you have include the regulators, the academic community, patients, of course, and industry, amongst many others. This topic of pain management and substance abuse, though, is very deeply personal for patients. What are some of the misconceptions in this field, and how does NIDA work to address them?
Unfortunately, there are many, many misconceptions in the field, and in a way that those misconceptions have actually contributed significantly to the current opioid crisis. I mean, the opioid crisis that we're living right now emerged out of the good intentions of the healthcare system to provide with treatment for patients that have severe pain. And the misconception started to emerge when physicians and providers start to become overconfident and to actually not question the information that was being fed to them, such as, very important misconception, if you have pain and you're given an opioid medication, you will not become addicted. And that misconception led to the overprescription practices. Another important misconception is if you actually increase slowly or the doses of the opioid that the patient has, because you become tolerant so very rapidly with this opioid medication. So in order to decrease the pain, you have to increase the doses again and again to levels that are very, very high. And the misconception was you could go as high as you wanted and there was no risk to the patient. Well, these two major misconceptions, on the one hand, led for patients with pain to become addicted, on the one hand, but it also led to patients who were being prescribed these pain medications to overdose because they were given such very high doses. And that sense of false safety with respect to these medications led in many instances to very cavalier ways of prescribing where the physician would not necessarily take the time to inquire whether his or her patient had already been given an opioid, was taking one, or was taking medications where there could be an adverse effect, such as benzodiazepines, or inquire about their drinking habits, all of which can increase the risk of overdoses. So these were major misconceptions. In parallel, another major misconception that we can still continue to live with is the notion that addiction is a choice behavior, that the person that is addicted takes the drugs because they want to have fun. When in fact, what we know, both from clinical experience as well as from studies in laboratory animals, is that when you become addicted to the drug, the motivation to take the drug is no longer that of seeking pleasure, but rather that of running away from a state of enormous discomfort. And this, of course, is exacerbated when you have a chronic pain situation. So you have a pain patient that has become addicted to their opioid medication. And there you have the discomfort from two things. One of them, that tremendous urge. It's like when you're incredibly hungry, you haven't eaten in 48 hours. That discomfort is exactly what a person addicted feels. And on top of that, they have the pain. And on top of that, they have another very adverse effect of opioids is that when you stop taking them, you have physical withdrawal. And that is also very painful. You feel very, very anxious, jittery, your heart is racing, you are sweating, you have cramps. So all of these collide into making it extraordinarily hard for a person that is addicted to their opioids to control those urges. And again, all of these rose because of those misconceptions that led the whole field into believing addiction being a choice behavior. Therefore, if my patient doesn't have the characteristics of a classically the prejudice of what a drug addicted person should be, I shouldn't worry about it. Plus, if they have pain, I shouldn't worry about it. And I can increase the doses as much as I can. All of that created a tsunami that resulted in really prescription practices that no matter how you look at it, are totally unjustified. Now, I'm going to pause here because there's another aspect of it that we cannot also not forget, that while we are over-prescribing all over America, that does not necessarily mean that we are giving better treatment for patients suffering from pain, because we are not. And we have to recognize the need of those patients, because if we don't address the need to provide better treatment for those suffering from pain, severe pain, or chronic pain, severe, we will never be able to get rid of a black market of opioid medications. We need to actually, and this again highlights why one of our priorities all along has been to develop compounds that can be as effective as opioid medications, but that are safer, that ideally are not addictive. And so we put an aspect and a priority in the whole opioid crisis to the development of alternative treatments for the management of pain. And so have the NIH as a whole identified this as one of its priorities.
This is quite a complex issue. And through your comments, you've mentioned many, many times how important it is to engage with the patient in this particular topic. Patients increasingly hold that voice in clinical research and drug development overall. But in this particular topic of pain management and substance abuse, what are the most direct opportunities for patients to engage in these discussions?
First of all, I mean, we are always urging patients to speak up to their doctors. And this is important because what happens is a doctor, and many times the doctors don't ask the questions that relate to behaviors that may be hinting that the person is becoming addicted to a drug or they are addicted to a drug. And we encourage patients to tell their doctors to speak about what they are experiencing. And we encourage doctors to do the same thing, to ask questions that relate to addiction. We also provide material, we generate material that is targeted on the one hand to lay public, and including parents that may be struggling with a child or teenagers, material targeted to teenagers, as well as physicians and health practitioners, educating them about substance use disorder. And two, also, we also provide material related to the management of opioids in a situation where a patient comes suffering from pain in order to be able to detect when the patient may in fact be malingering or not really aware of what they are doing, where the use of an opioid is not justified. So that's one of the aspects that we do at the NIH and at NIDA to try to increase the education of providers and patients. Of course, our main goal is to obtain a knowledge that can be used to provide evidence of what works and doesn't work. And we partner with organizations to ensure that that information can be transferred to their members. So, for example, with the American Psychiatric Association, with the American Child Psychiatry Association, with the American Psychological Association, so that they have access to this information and they, as medical organizations, can transmit it. And we also overall have very open dialogue, and we've become over the years actually also paying much more attention to the organizations that represent the patients. In the case of addictions, those organizations did not really exist until very recently. And now that they are starting to form, it's a very important source for us because we can communicate with them that information that relates to the disease that they are struggling with or their family members, but also to hear from them what are their concerns, what are the areas where we could help develop science and knowledge and evidence that could help them. So that is another component of how we disseminate that information.
It sounds like there's an incredible amount going on in a topic that's very, very important and of interest to DIA's members. Moving now to our upcoming DIA annual meeting in June, could you tell us a little bit about the topics that you plan to address and specifically perhaps focusing on advances in pain management?
Yes, I want to take advantage of the opportunity that you are going to have representatives from industry to make them aware of the exciting science that is emerging out of the field, both on addiction, but also on pain management. Because there are opportunities for investment and development of tools that could be very, very valuable. So it could be a win-win. You end up actually having a very profitable product while at the same time coming up with a product that will help a lot of Americans or people all over the world. I mean, care science doesn't belong to anyone in particular by delivering solutions to problems. So in the field, for example, of pain, we've focused an enormous amount on the development of medications. And they are, again, because of fast advances occurring in neuroscience and technologies and tools, we now have identified many more targets that potentially and certainly in animal models appear to be promising for management of pain. So bringing them up into the clinic is something that is very, very natural. And the NIH has established, again, programs that can facilitate the risk those molecules and conduct some of the testing that will make small industry that may not have that level of capital interested on investing in this particular area. But there's also an enormous amount of potential for devices. For example, one area that has started to just blossom and there's an enormous amount of research ongoing is the area of peripheral or stimulation devices. Actually, they have been tested for a wide variety of diseases, but certainly one of them is pain, and so is addiction. Also, the use of stimulation of the brain through the skull, whether it is through magnetic currents or through electrical stimulation, transcranial magnetic stimulation or electrical current stimulation. Those tools, which have actually been approved for the treatment of depression, have been shown in research to be actually very promising for decreasing pain sensation on a wide variety of pain syndromes. So we are extremely interested on pushing that whole area of research of devices, whether it's peripheral or whether they deliver these pulses through the skull, to maximize the ability to control pain in patients suffering from it. There's also, in the device world, a lot of interest on designing devices that can help you monitor and basically predict through biofeedback mechanisms, teach that person how to properly regulate brain rhythms in a way that enable them to control their pain better. So in the past, for example, we were using just basically how fast electrical signals go in your skin to determine, to actually give you feedback about whether what you are doing is helpful or not in, for example, decreasing anxiety or in decreasing pain. Now we can use imaging devices that can go from electroencephalography to actually MRI to provide that information to the patient and teach them how to optimally, for example, inhibit areas of the brain that are processing pain signals. And we all can do this to a certain extent, but when we have these biofeedback processes, you can actually do it much more efficiently. To devices that are monitoring you on a 24-hour basis to actually help you determine when or what stimuli may trigger the sensation of pain so that you can anticipate it and learn how to avoid it. To the electronic healthcare devices that allow you to connect with someone that can serve as a coach to help you manage whether it's addiction or whether you manage pain. So this is an example of the gamut of opportunities that currently exist for development of devices in the management of pain and addiction.
As you know, Dr. Volkow, our members in DIA are very, very active in healthcare product development and lifecycle management. Are there specific opportunities that organizations like DIA or our members should know about to contribute to the work of NIDA?
Oh, absolutely. And we have mechanisms. And again, this is not just the work of NIDA. The NIH as a whole is very interested on accelerating these devices for the treatment of pain. And NIDA is interested advancing it for pain, but also for addiction. And there are, for example, one of the mechanisms we have is grants that are targeted for small industry. We also have grant mechanisms that allow us to partner with large pharmaceuticals or large devices. So depending on the size of the industry, there are different mechanisms. We are also creating new mechanisms that actually specifically require that the principal investigator have a partnership with an industry partner that will result in advancing that particular device or medication into the clinic. So we are trying to be as creative as possible to facilitate translation research, which is actually one of the big hurdles in terms of as we develop knowledge. Many times it takes much longer to bring that knowledge into a product that one would like. And in other instances, that knowledge may never make the light of day because it's harder. It's what is called the valley of death. So we're trying to be very creative in the way that we try to put in bridges that can help cross that valley of debt. And we're trying to be as creative as possible in terms of mechanisms to understand what the needs of different industry may be, what the state of the science is, what the needs of patients are.
A very important topic, and I look forward to hearing the rest of your comments at the upcoming annual meeting. Finally, Dr. Volkow, what did I not ask you that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I think that one of the aspects that I would like to share is that, unfortunately, this opioid crisis has made us face the fact that addiction is something that can happen to any one of us or any one of our family members. That is not an isolated entity, that there are not certain demographics that are going to be associated with addiction. That depending on the circumstances, as now shown, any one of us can become addicted. And yet, because there has been that big stigma about addiction being seen as a choice behavior, we have not paid attention to it. And this is why we are currently here. And we have not paid attention to it, not just in terms of what the healthcare system has done, but what industry has invested on in trying to come up with solutions. We've come to realize that these addiction, as well as other behavioral diseases, which are put under the rubric of diseases of distress, are basically now taking over as the major causes of morbidity in our country, but also in the globe, highlighting again the importance of focusing on what may be products and interventions that can prevent these diseases of distress. And if they happen, that can come up with therapeutic solutions. We cannot keep it running away from it. What it has done, that's running away from us, it has catch up with this opioid crisis. And we cannot close our eyes.
Dr. Volkow, thank you for your time today.
Thanks very much for having me, and thanks very much for your interest. And I also look forward to meeting you in person.
For DIA, I'm Barbara Lopez-Kunz.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.